The UFC hops to the Midwest for a big show on Fox Saturday night. However, the New York State Athletic Commission is still wiping some egg off their face after what happened last Saturday night. And you might hear a few more lame Easter-related puns. It is Friday, April 14, 2017, and Josh Jason's Punch-Out is here. Hi, everyone. Welcome. It is episode 63, Josh Nason's Punch-Out here on WrestlingObserver.com. I'm Josh Nason, writer, editor, podcaster for the website, all-around good guy. Hope everything's going well with you. It is Easter weekend coming up for those of you that celebrate, or for those of you who just like a free meal on Sunday if you're really hungover, raise his hand. Let's see. All kinds of stuff going on. It is a huge weekend. As always, in the world of MMA, we have a big show on Saturday night, UFC on Fox, with a really fun show from top to bottom. Some names that you know, and this one kind of snuck up on us, but it is on the doorstep. We had, obviously, last weekend with some very surprising events with UFC 210, that sounds about right? Daniel Cormier defending his title successfully, light heavyweight championship against the now-retired Anthony Johnson. That's kind of still weird. Chris Weidman struggling in his return against Gegard Mousasi, but the New York State Athletic Commission really doing a hatchet job on that whole thing. And overall, just other interesting stuff on the show. Patrick Cote retiring. We had a Bellator show happen last Saturday afternoon, which, you know, if a tree falls in the woods and no one's around to hear it, did it actually happen? And then we have, of course, a Bellator show coming up on this Friday night. And we have a UFC show coming up on Saturday and all kinds of other news as well. So what I did is, you know, it has been a while. Obviously, we returned last week with a very fun show with Aaron Bronstetter. This week, we went 90 minutes, guys, 90 minutes. This one may take you two listens to get through unless you have a super long commute, or maybe you're traveling for Easter and you're going to listen to this show. Regardless, we have a guy that is an expert in the Midwest, and not only an expert in the Midwest, but an expert in fighting. He's been calling fights forever. If you have watched MMA for any period of time, you've heard his voice at some point. He is Sean Wheelock. Sean, the former voice of Bellator MMA, now doing all kinds of different promotions all over the place. Boxing, MMA, and doing even some soccer as well. And I want to talk to Sean actually before the events of what happened on Saturday night with the New York State Athletic Commission. Sean works for the in a non-paid role for the Kansas Athletic Commission, really involved in regulatory affairs. So it just happens that we had him on this week to talk about all this other crazy stuff. So what did we talk about for 90 minutes? What didn't we talk about? We talked about, his new podcast with Ben Askren and Joe Warren. We talked about the whole Bellator situation, Bjorn Remedy coming back, obviously, for the MMAAA. I think that's the right one. Regardless, what he thought when he saw his buddy, his old friend, his old boss, Bjorn Remedy, on screen with these guys and Cain Velasquez, and kind of what happened and what he thinks is going to happen next with Bjorn. That was an interesting topic of conversation. Obviously, everything that happened with the New York State Athletic Commission with Chris Weidman and Gegard Mousasi and what he would have done differently, and just some of the issues that arise with regulatory affairs. We talked about more Ronaldo, his thoughts about that. We talked a little bit about your fight. If you remember that, he actually called a wrestling match with Kurt Angle and Rey Mysterio, 2 out of 3 falls, as well as a little bit of his time or his appearance in TNA. So we touched on that. We talked about, it's been well over a year since he was with Bellator, if he's changed his views on how that went down at all. And obviously, we talked about this Saturday night, UFC on Fox happening in his neck of the woods in Kansas City, and all kinds of other stuff. And at the end of the conversation, we actually, near the end of the conversation, we talked about the infamous night in Connecticut when UFC and Bellator running head-to-head shows against each other, when Tito Ortiz versus Stefan Bonner, when that was first announced, the mysterious man with the mask, all that stuff, he was calling the action that night. So we had some pretty good stories about that and all kinds of other things. This was a really good conversation, really fun. If you're an MMA geek, I think you're really going to enjoy this. If you're not, I don't know why you hit play on this. But yeah, this is for MMA lovers. I think you're really going to enjoy this a lot. We jumped all over the map and a lot of interesting stuff here. 90 minutes, could have gone 3 hours. I hope you guys enjoy it. Enjoy Sean Wheelock of Pretty Much Everywhere on Josh Nason's Punch Up. Hit it. Well, as UFC heads back out to the beautiful Midwest, we head out to the Midwest for a very special guest, someone I've been wanting to talk to for a very long time here, and I'm glad we were able to finally make it happen, even on a very busy week for him. He is, you know him, obviously, as he used to be the voice of Bellator MMA. He is an author. He is someone that's been on Wrestling Observer Radio with Dave and Brian before, if you know him from there. He is the voice of Victory MMA. He has a great podcast. He is also a former TNA announcer, at least for one match or one segment back in the day. And with that, we'd like to open up the floor and welcome Sean Wheelock to the show. And Sean, we'll start you out with the really hardball stuff first. I mean, every night you must wake up and be like, "Wow, I was a TNA announcer for one or so matches." That must be the epitome and the pinnacle of your career.
Oh, it was such a huge deal for me, and I'm a complete mark, and I'm happy to admit that I'm a total mark. And let me say, too, I'm a big fan of your work, and I'm really pleased that you reached out to me, and thank you, and I'm so glad that we can talk. And it's really, you do a great job, and I think you and I share very, very similar interests across pro wrestling and across MMA and combat sports and regulation and media. So it's a big thrill and an honor for me to be on the program. And as someone who grew up going to Memorial Hall in Kansas City, Kansas, more Thursday evenings than not, and to have sat in and done one bout on TNA was a lot of fun. How that worked was, it was at the time when I was doing Bellator, TNA was still on Spike. We had a Bellator in Tampa, and our executive producer, who was also the executive producer, a Spike employee, was the executive producer for TNA. He knew that I was a huge wrestling fan. He said, "Why don't you come on over and you can meet everyone?" And when I got there, they said, "Hey, you want to sit in and call a match?" I said, "What, are you kidding me? Of course I do." So I got to sit in. It was a great time. Everybody was so incredibly nice. They could not have been nicer to me. And it's funny, on my Wikipedia page, and I didn't plan this. I'm not technologically savvy enough to even know how to do an entry on my Wikipedia page. Uh-huh. If I was, it would say a lot more. It would say a lot more cool things about me than it does. But somebody wrote in that I sat in for one match, and I get a big kick out of that. It's amazing how many people who I've known for a long time, I had no idea that they were into the kayfabe, that they were marks like me, said, "I saw you on TNA. I saw you on pro wrestling." It's funny what hits and doesn't hit and what people watch and don't watch. And it was really a highlight for me. It was so much fun. And then last year, I got to call the Rey Mysterio-Kurt Angle match with JR, who I'm thrilled, by the way, is back in WWE, and that was just another thrill and an honor for me. So I guess I've done two pro wrestling matches now in my career.
That's right. That was the UR Fight pay-per-view, correct?
That's right. That was one of the most fun shows I've ever had. It was crazy, and it was disorganized. And it felt like a train going way over its speed limit about to veer off the tracks. And yet it all came together. It was so much fun. I've known Quentin Rampage Jackson for a long time through MMA. And as I tell people, there's this guy called Rampage, and then there's this guy called Quentin Jackson. And they're two different people. And Quentin Jackson was there at the fights, but then he became Rampage on the air, too.
Yep.
And it was a good thing we were on internet pay-per-view, because he hit a lot of words that, had it been over the air, the FCC might have sent a nasty letter or an email or maybe even a fine to. But Quentin was in great form, and to sit next to Jim Ross, someone who I've really looked up to in this business for a long time and who I'm now happy to say I count as a friend and has done a lot for me personally in my career, that was a lot of fun. It was boxing. It was MMA. There was submission grappling, which turned out to be terrible, Chael Sonnen and Michael Bisping.
Yep.
And then there was pro wrestling, which was great. And other than Sonnen and Bisping maybe not laying it out the way I'd hoped in submission grappling, I had a great time on that card. It was really a thrill. And to sit next to Jim Ross while he's calling pro wrestling, that's a really rare, unique experience.
Yeah, I remember that show, and that's right. I remember you were there because I covered the show for our site. I was completely fascinated by it because it's like you get a show that's like, again, boxing, wrestling, and MMA on the same show. Kurt Angle versus Rey Mysterio, 2 out of 3 falls. Roy Jones, if people remember, he was going to box a fan, but then the commission, I guess, wouldn't allow him to do that. So they found like
that was the work. I hate to tell you, that was the work. He was never going to box a fan. The idea was that people who had some experience, be it as a pro boxer or Golden Gloves or even an MMA, whatever, could submit. And it was billed as a gimmick. It was a work. He was going to box a fan. I think that 10 names were selected by Roy Jones Jr. And then the Arizona Athletic Commission looked at those. And I think they pared it down to 3. And then they came together with a guy named Byron Phillips, who is an MMA fighter out of Minnesota. I think he was 7-1 in MMA at the time. And he had done some amateur boxing, but didn't have a pro boxing record. But Byron was definitely a fan of Roy's. Don't get me wrong. He was a huge fan. I thought he was going to ask for an autograph right before the bell rang. But he was also a legitimate pro fighter. Yeah. But that was part of the fun of the event that they wrapped it up. Oh, yeah, he's going to fight a fan. Like someone's 45-year-old dad is going to come out of the audience and be pummeled mercilessly by Roy Jones Jr. Instead, he was an MMA fighter named Byron Phillips who was pummeled mercilessly by Roy Jones Jr.
So one last question about your fight. I'm going to say 2 words and see what your first reaction is. Riff Raff.
I've never heard of Riff Raff, and I've got young kids, so we unfortunately listen to a lot of Top 40 radio in the car. My wife likes that. I'm more of a Nirvana guy myself, but I didn't know who Riff Raff was, and they told me Riff Raff's on the card, so I quickly did my Google and Wikipedia research. I was like, all right. Didn't see him backstage. I heard some interesting backstage stories about smells and different plumes of smoke coming from his dressing room. But then he came out and he did his thing. And I believe the angle they were setting up, had there been a Your Fights 2 or Your Show Fights 2, that there would be a tag team match. And it didn't come to fruition. And I really wish that it would have. I felt like they caught lightning in a bottle on that show. The execution wasn't great. It could have been better. But they also touched a nerve on something where I think that you can do a hybrid card where you have MMA, pro boxing, and pro wrestling, and submission grappling, and maybe throw in a Muay Thai sometime, and to put all those together in a really fun, unfiltered, freewheeling internet pay-per-view. So perhaps they'll do another one. But Riff Raff, it was very interesting. And clearly he was a pro wrestling fan. I don't really know much about his career. I know he's a rapper. And he had sold some albums or some downloads, I guess. But I don't think he's not on the A-list, but he definitely was a pro wrestling fan. And I think getting into the ring, I think he worked okay. I didn't think he really embarrassed himself. I mean, people said that he embarrassed himself by his hair and his clothes, but actually working in pro wrestling against two legends like Kurt Angle and Rey Mysterio, I didn't think he was horrible. I don't know. What did you think on that?
I thought because
pretty horrible.
yeah. What was not the best. I wouldn't give him 6 stars. Put it that way.
No, for sure. It just added to the spectacle. But yeah. I'll say this. I think he was better than when Buster Douglas was in WWE, or maybe William the Refrigerator Perry. I was trying to give it a sliding scale of other people who have come into pro wrestling or even going back to Muhammad Ali, but it was very, very interesting. You know, I'm so dogmatic on doing my fighter interviews and wanting to talk to everybody. And when it came to Riff Raff, I thought, I can't be bothered. I have nothing to say to him. What's he going to tell me?
So good segue. Cause, as we were talking the past couple of days, what state are you in right now?
So right now I'm talking to you from Omaha, Nebraska. I'm here for VFC Victory Fighting Championship 56. It's on UFC Fight Pass. And I'm a Kansan. I live in Kansas City, but I live on the Kansas side. So I'm about a 3-hour drive north of my house. It's funny. It seems like all of the gigs that I do right now, I'm either getting on a plane, flying to places like China and Russia. I'm going to Ingushetia, Russia next week for M1. Or I get in a car and I drive to Wichita, or I drive to Des Moines, or I drive to Omaha. I like these driving gigs, though. They're very, very relaxing to me.
Yeah, you've been staying pretty busy. You were in Mexico this past weekend for boxing, if I remember right, and then obviously victory.
I was in Cancun. That's right, absolutely.
In Cancun. Usually there's a lot of boxing or a lot of fighting in Cancun, but typically it's on the streets during spring break. So you were all over the place. So you've been keeping really busy with all kinds of different gigs and things like that. So where, for those that are obviously with Fight Pass and all these different things, where can people generally find you when it comes to, different combat sports?
So I'm commentating Victory, which is on UFC Fight Pass. And people who haven't watched Victory, it's really good. And I like the honesty of Victory. Ryan Stoddard, who's a former pro fighter, and he's been a manager, he's been a gym owner, he's a young guy. I think Ryan is 32 or 33, one of the more ambitious people I've ever met in combat sports. He says, we're the AAA, and his goal is to be the AAA of the UFC. And a good indication of the fights, for instance, in our main event, it's Rob Emerson. Rob Emerson fought 7 times in the UFC.
Yep.
He's looking to successfully defend his Victory 135-pound title. I was talking to Rob Emerson about 2 hours ago after the weigh-ins, and he really feels like if he wins this fight, he'll go back to the UFC. His opponent is Rafion Stotts. And if you haven't heard of Rafion Stotts before, I think you're going to, regardless of the outcome of the Emerson fight. He's 7-0. He's a 2-time NCAA Division II wrestling national champion. He's out of Rufus Sport. And I'm really close with Ben Askren. We've been close since the Bellator days. We do the podcast together along with Joe Warren. I love Ben, but when you ask Ben about any fighter or any wrestler, he'll tell you they're terrible. It's just reflexive of Ben. No matter who it is, oh, he's awful. That's just who Ben is. He doesn't think anybody's any good. And when I did Rafion Stotts' first fight a year ago, I said, hey, I'm with a teammate of yours, Rafion Stotts. And Ben said, kid's a monster. He's outstanding. So I teased Rafion. I said, Ben thinks everyone is horrible, and then he told me that you're outstanding. Tells me that you're really, really good, because Ben does not give out compliments like that. So that's the type of fight in Victory that you're seeing. You have one guy who's been in the UFC. Rob Emerson was also in Bellator when I was there, who still is very relevant and thinks he can go back to the UFC. And you have someone in Rafion Stotts who's entering his 8th pro MMA fight, who seems destined for the UFC. I think promotions right now, not named the Ultimate Fighting Championship, really need to figure out who they are and what they want to be. And that's one thing I like a lot about Victory. They know who they are and they know what they want to be. And there's no reason that you can't be the AAA of the UFC and be very proud about that. There's no shame in that whatsoever. I have a lot more admiration for that than mid-level organizations who posture and act like they're better than the UFC. And then I also commentate for M1, and it's funny because I was with M1. That was my gig for 2 years before Bellator. That was where Jimmy Smith and I started together as a commentary team. I did M1 in 2008 and 2009. And at the time, they were run out of the Netherlands. The management team was all Dutch. And I had a fun time, but it was pretty disorganized. And last year, M1 contacted me, asked me if I'd be interested in going back. And I did one show, and I thought, well, let's see what this is like. They're brilliant. They're phenomenal. They're run all by Russians now. Most of them are in their 30s. They're all fight fans. They're really knowledgeable. It's one of the smoothest, if not the smoothest, promotions now that I've worked for. And just last month in Moscow, I did Paul Bradley versus Alexander Shlemenko in front of a sold-out crowd of about 11,000 people. I mean, how is that for a main event? It was a great fight. I think that's definitely a main event in Bellator in a different universe. I really think that could have been a Bellator main event. And it's a great promotion. They have fighters from Russia, from Eastern Europe, from Western Europe, from Brazil, from the U.S. and Canada. I'm having a blast doing M1. You can see those if you're listening to us and you're in the U.S. and Canada. You can find those online. And then I got back into boxing. And boxing was the first combat sport that I did on television way back in 2000 or 2001 when I was a fill-in for Friday Night Fights on ESPN. And when I was under contract with Bellator, I wasn't allowed to do any other combat sports. Obviously, no other MMA, but not boxing, Muay Thai, kickboxing. I don't think I could have done Gi Jiu-Jitsu. And I had now had the opportunity, and I'm having a lot of fun doing boxing. I did a fight with a U.S. Olympian named Nico Hernandez, his pro debut, a few weeks ago. I have this series in Cancun, which is not a bad thing. I think I'm headed to Cancun 6 or 8 times this year. It's really fun. It's great to get to do different sports. I just need a Muay Thai gig now, and I'm set.
Nice, nice. Get the fill out the bracket there, so to speak. When these promotions come to you, and I'm sure there's, you know, over the years there have been, you know, smaller different promotions and different mid-size that have come to you. How do you evaluate whether or not to take the gig? Because obviously, when you're doing all these different things, and you know, quality is obviously, I know that that's very important to you, but like, how do you determine when to say yes, when to say no, when to kick the tires a bit, what questions do you ask, and so on and so forth?
I think that's a great question. Look, we're all interested in money, and money is a factor, but I've been very fortunate in my career, and the money that I've made, I've been extremely fortunate. Fortunate to where I find myself in a position that it doesn't just have to be about the money, that I have the flexibility to be able to say no to a show. And without naming names, if you look at some shows that I've done post Bellator and I'm not doing anymore, I didn't feel that maybe they had the highest level of organization that I wanted, or it was just the right fit for me. It's not necessarily that they're bad people, and I don't want to say anything bad about anybody. I'm certainly not going to call anyone out, but I'm looking for, obviously, I have a rate and I have to have my rate hit, but if it's something I really want to do, I'm not too worried about the money. They have to pay me to a certain point, but it's not just about, oh, I could make $1,500 or $2,000 more doing this show. That's not what it's about for me. At the end of the day, I really think it's go to a place where you feel good about your work and you feel like people appreciate what you do. And that's a lot of fun. You know, I had an experience in Bellator 5.5 years. I believe I did 129 straight Bellators. It went from under Bjorn Rebney to the greatest gig I ever had to the last 6 months. It was by far the worst gig that I've ever had. There's no question. And I'm not indicting Scott Coker. That's an indictment on the Spike executives who took over TV when Bjorn Rebney left. And even though the money was phenomenal on that series, I wasn't having that much fun. And that, to me, is kind of missing the point if you're not having fun. Right. It shouldn't just have to be about the money. So I really like your question on that. So when people call me directly or if they call my agent, I'm looking at who the organization is, who the fighters are, where the fight is. I might talk to them and get a sense of them. And I'll go from there. And I'll usually try somebody once. And if it's just not the right fit, it's not the right fit, and no hard feelings. But I really want to be there, and I want it to be organized, and I want it to be a fun environment. And if they can tick those two boxes and they're happy with what I do, then I'm quite happy to stick around.
And one thing I don't think I've ever heard you talk about is, how did you first get started in commentating? What inspired you growing up? At what point did your path move towards talking for a living?
So I was one of those kids who sat in front of the television with a tape recorder. I'm a child of the 80s to have actually had a tape recorder, and would call commentary. And literally as far back as I can remember, I wanted to be a sports commentator. I mean, I think I wanted to be an athlete, like a lot of kids want to be an athlete, but I think reality also caught up to me pretty quickly on what it means to be even a really good amateur athlete, let alone a professional athlete. But I wanted to do it. And we moved into our current house about 5 years ago, and I found a shoebox of these tapes. And it was me, like 8, 9, 10 years old, calling play-by-play off of television. And I've heard other play-by-play commentators relay similar stories. It just is something in you where you want to do that. Maybe you've personally had that experience too, working in media, where you can look back and find things that you recorded or that you wrote where you're leading yourself to that. But in high school, I remember I went and I saw the vice principal, who was the athletics director. And I said, I want to be the PA announcer for the basketball team. And he said, well, we always have a teacher who does that. And I said, well, I think it should be me. And he said, I'll give you one game. And I did it. And then I was the PA announcer for the basketball team. And even though that wasn't radio, it felt like a broadcasting gig to me. And then I just continually pursued it. And I was determined to be in broadcasting and to be in sports broadcasting no matter what. I was raised by a single mom, the best mom in the world, who's still my biggest supporter. And she was a public school art teacher. She didn't know anybody who knew anybody who knew anybody in sports or broadcasting. It was literally, you have to figure this out on your own. You have to meet the right people. You have to be persistent. It's a very weird path, as you well know, just like I do. It's a weird path. There are no straight lines or a lot of swerves and jags and diagonals to get there.
Yep.
But I think ultimately it comes down to persistence, or at least it did for me, to be persistent. I was always a sports fan as a kid. I was always fascinated by the commentators. I remember being a kid, little kid, grade school, and being excited to see certain commentators that I liked. And I don't know a lot of people who did that. I was just always fascinated on that part of the industry.
So it's funny you mentioned different, like find the tapes. So very similarly, stepmother ended up selling one of the house I grew up in after my father passed away years and years ago. And she's, you know, like, you gotta kind of get your stuff or else it's going to the dump. And I'm like, well, there's all kinds of wrestling magazines there. I have to go back and save those right away. And I found a correspondence report that I sent in as a kid to Inside Wrestling, which is part of the PWI family, kind of the extended family.
Oh, absolutely. Are you kidding? I have loads of copies of Inside Wrestling in a box somewhere in my storage room.
Well, I will almost guarantee that somewhere in there you will find a correspondent report from yours truly. I think it was the Undertaker and the Berserker were in the main event at the Cumberland County Civic Center in Portland, Maine. And you see these things and it's like, you figure out like along the way where the bug kind of bit you, and seeing that first thing, and I'm sure that obviously you've had the same way, like your first game, and then people are like, wow, that was good. They hear you, and they're like, you kind of become part of something that's a little bit bigger, and it's intoxicating to actually have that. And the one thing I always loved about both writing or any broadcasting, when I was doing a little bit of stuff in high school or just any of these type of things, was you get that immediate gratification of, do people like it or not like it? And then you move on to the next thing. I was just always just intoxicated by that.
See, I knew that we were kindred spirits on that. And I knew that you would have a story just like me of having something from your childhood. And I think that that's really a vein that runs through, if not all of us, certainly a great deal of us who wind up in this industry, that it's just this burning desire from the time that you're a little kid that you want to be part of the media. You're going to write something, or you're going to record a demo or do a pretend newscast in front of a camera or do an audition. It's just that driving passion where you're not going to be denied to get into this business. I was the type of kid too, and maybe you had the same experience where you would start calling in the sports radio stations, and I've always looked about 8 years younger, and I've always sounded, maybe finally my voice got to a register I'm proud of, but as a kid, I always sounded so much younger, and calling into these sports radio stations sounding like I was 6 years old, and I was probably 12,
yeah.
And just not being denied to get into the industry like that, I think that's great.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So, I want to talk about, before we kind of go on to what happened this past weekend in New York, and I know obviously you've talked about that, or just you're very familiar with the situation. And you mentioned Bellator, and I have to wonder what your reaction was when few months ago this new quote unquote union Fighters Association was being announced, has gone MIA since then, and your old boss Bjorn Rebney was there with Cain Velasquez, TJ Dillashaw, Cowboy Cerrone, George St. Pierre, and this guy that had been, you know, the famous tweet Mexico, and it just disappeared, disappeared off the face of the earth, and then all of a sudden just reappeared. And what were you thinking when you saw him and being involved in this new thing? And yeah, what was going through your head?
Well, I know Bjorn really well, and I don't know if it's my personality, but there are a lot of people who aren't that well-liked in MMA, and I like them a lot. And Bjorn Rebney is one of those people. I'm a Bjorn Rebney loyalist. I'm not an apologist. I'm not a defender. I'm a loyalist. And I judge people on how they treated me, mm-hmm. and Bjorn treated me beautifully. If Bjorn Rebney hadn't sold out to Viacom and gotten fired, then I wouldn't have gotten fired by Viacom. The MMA landscape would look much different than it does now, and I would still be the voice of Bellator MMA, or Bellator Fighting Championships, as Bjorn wanted to call it. Bellator MMA was the spike name when Bjorn was still there. I know how smart he is, and beyond that, I know how determined he is. I don't know how much money Bjorn got in the settlement. You know, you hear numbers. I've heard $3 million. I've heard $10 million. I've heard $100,000. I have no idea. But what I know is no matter how much money Bjorn got, he wouldn't just go lie on a beach in Mexico or elsewhere. He's too determined. He's too driven. So Bjorn is someone, when he was fired by Spike, I immediately called him up. We had a long conversation. I thanked him for everything that he had done for my career, for looking out for me. And I knew pretty early on that the Spike guys weren't digging what I was doing. And I've said that before, and I've talked about that publicly and privately. And Bjorn said to me, "Sean, as long as this is my company and I'm in charge, you will be my commentator." And he was true to his word on that. He was gone in June of 2014, and I got fired 13 months later. Bjorn always looked out for me, and we're still friends. But after that initial conversation, I would call him from time to time just to say, hey, just on a friendship level. It would always ring through, and the subscriber you have called has a voicemail that has not been set up. So, and I know he did that on purpose. But I would text him, and he would text back, and it was never about the industry. It was never about MMA. He would ask me about my daughters or ask me about my mom or my wife. I would ask him about his son Jonathan or his wife Huma, just seeing how things were doing. But he never tipped his hand to me. And I had a feeling that something was coming. I didn't know when. I didn't know where. I didn't know what, why, or how. But I had a feeling that something was coming. I don't think you've heard the last of Bjorn Rebney, and I say this with absolutely no insight. Again, I just go back to the guy is incredibly smart, and he's incredibly determined. Something is going to happen out of this, exactly what I don't know. But I don't think Bjorn reemerged just to have a round of media talks and a big press conference and then disappear again. Obviously, there are three groups that are competing right now for players' associations. I don't know what's going to happen on that. I doubt they'll all come together. They all seem pretty much at odds.
Yeah.
But I cannot envision a scenario where Bjorn Rebney does not come back into MMA in some capacity.
Yeah, he came in pretty hot, you know, and I think that was the thing when, you know, he was really going after UFC strong, and it was very surreal, the whole thing. And then, you know, he just kind of like disappeared again and hasn't been tweeting since then and all that. So knowing him as well as you do, and again, as you mentioned, not really having any intel, you think we have not heard the last of him on this front or just in the fight game as a whole?
In the fight game as a whole. And I don't know what's happening with this union. And then immediately Donald Cerrone was saying things that probably were a little off script.
Mm-hmm.
But in the fight game, Bjorn's going to show up. Look, and I say this in all seriousness, if Spike gave him, or I should say more correctly, Viacom, gave him a $100 million exit package, Bjorn would still be plotting his return. He's just not that guy who's just going to take his money and not do anything. He's just too determined and too driven, and he genuinely loves MMA. And I think it's unfortunate that a lot of fans judge the Bjorn Rebney they saw later in the Bellator run. But the Bjorn Rebney who I'm friends with, who I think about fondly, is the Bjorn Rebney who hired me in 2010. And we had that series in 2010. I believe we did 24 shows, and we were on Fox Sports 1. Or no, I beg your pardon, there was no Fox Sports 1 then. We were on Fox Sports Net.
Yes.
So more often than not, on your Fox Sports regional, you would be on it. We would be on at 3 in the morning after the Big 12 basketball game of the week or the Minnesota Twins or the LA Kings. And we had so much fun, and it was such a great group of people. And I had come over to Bellator with Jimmy Smith, who at the time was one of my best friends. We had done 2 years in M1. Sam Kaplan, who's still a great friend, who I worked with at M1. Joe Kelly, who gave me my first commentating gig at Titan, the original Titan, which led me directly to the Pride gig, still a good friend. We came over as a group, and it just felt really special. Those were the days when after a show, Bjorn would invite us back up into his hotel suite, and we would sit around and drink and talk, and he'd say, what do you think about this fighter? Who should I sign here? What do I look at? All of that changed, and once Bjorn lost control of his company, and look, this is life. If you are the boss, and then you sell your majority stake, and you become an employee, it's going to be different, and that's the experience that Bjorn Rebney had, and I think a lot of people outside of the industry. I'm not going to defend him, and I know there are a lot of people who will say I had a bad experience with him. I've had nothing but great experiences with him, but I know the stories that are out there. But just from a fan's perspective, a lot of fans judge him on what they saw, say, 2013 and on, when Bellator moved to Spike. And he was in a position where he couldn't really be himself, and we all saw that. But if you go back and you look at the interviews that he gave in 2010 and the press conferences he gave, that's the real Bjorn Redmond for sure.
Hmm. Bellator, you had been well over a year since they let you go, and you had done a lot of interviews about that and talked about that a lot. As we sit here in, April 2017, is there any other different reflections since that point? Any just how you, I don't say how you would have done things differently, because I don't know if you really would have, but you know what I mean? Has anything over time changed as far as your opinion from when, you know, you first were let go?
No, I still watch Bellator, and I watched the first show because I got fired, I think, and this is July of 2015, but it was something like 4 or 5 days before I was set to get on the plane to fly to our show in Mohegan Sun. Mm-hmm. We had done the show, which was the Ken Shamrock Kimbo Slice card in St. Louis. The following week, immediately, we were in Wichita. And then there was, I think, like a 3-week gap before we were going to Mohegan Sun. So it was 3 or 4 days, I think, maybe 5 at the most, before I was set to get on the plane when I got the call, and I was literally blindsided. As I thought about it in hindsight, there were definitely clues. But also, and I've stated this publicly before, my agent, I'm represented by a pretty good agency, Wasserman Media Group. I mean, my agent personally, she's a media and a player and coaches agent. So she has had coaches in the NBA. She's a really good agent. She knows what she's doing. She's also an attorney. And she had been trying to get my new contract done. I was under a 3 or 4 year deal, but all of my previous deals had been signed through Bjorn Redmond. So this is my first contract coming up where we would have to deal with Viacom and Spike, not Bjorn Redmond. But Bjorn would never let me get inside of 12 months before he would come and offer me more money and a new deal. So once we got inside of the year, because that contract was up on December, I think it was a 4 year, it was 3 or 4 year deal, but it was up December 31st, 2015. And once we got inside of a year, I started to get a little concerned. And my agent said, no, everything is great. And she was talking to Viacom at least 2 or 3 times a month. And they just said, oh, we have to work things out. The week before I got fired, my agent was still told, we love Sean. He's the best in the business. He's our guy moving forward. We just need to get some dates figured out, and we need to get it sorted out. Meanwhile, as I've come to find out, because for whatever reason, he was very, very public in his pronouncements on this. I don't know his motivation, but my replacement talked about, I think they had contacted him in February, and I think he'd been under contract since February or March, just basically sitting and waiting and getting ready. And that was the climate it was in. So I think that hating people is something that takes away a lot of energy, and I really don't hate anybody. I guess as I reflect, look, if they wanted to get rid of me, fair enough. That's the industry. I mean, look at what's happening to Phil Simms in the NFL. You know, it usually doesn't end well for you anywhere in a high-profile job. Had they just been honest and said, Shawnee, we're not going to renew you. We expect you to fill out your year. We know you'll be a professional. We're going to treat you well. We're going to pay you your money. But know that at the end of the year, we're not going to re-sign you. So start looking for a new job now. I wouldn't have been thrilled, but I would have respected that. What bothered me, and I guess to a certain extent still bothers me, is that they were just flat-out liars, and that wasn't great. John McCarthy, I count as one of my best friends in the world, and I think it must go back to his LAPD days, because John will forgive a lot of things and a lot of people, but he won't forgive liars. And I think the influence John has had on me through our deep friendship, I think I've become more like John in that way, that I can forgive a lot of things and a lot of people. I'm a really easygoing guy. I'm an extremely non-judgmental person. I don't like being lied to, and that's probably what bothered me. But when I watch Bellator now, it doesn't even feel like Bellator anymore. So many people who I worked with on the production side, on the talent relations side, through the matchmakers, even so many fighters who I was close to, they're gone now. It feels like a different show. The first year I watched Bellator, it still felt like my show. Almost felt voyeuristic at times. Now I watch Bellator, and it's like I'm watching World Series of Fighting. It's just a completely different series to me. I think there's some really good fights. Some things I think they're doing well. Some things I think they're doing really poorly. But I still enjoy watching the series, because at the end of the day, I'm a fight guy. It's just definitely not Bellator anymore. I think they probably, and maybe in hindsight, they wish they would have renamed it, because it's a different company. And fair enough. Viacom bought it. They own 97%. They brought in Scott Coker. They should make it a different company. It would be insane to buy a company, fire the founder, and then run things status quo. So that's their prerogative.
Do you ever go to a Windstar Casino or Thackerville, Oklahoma, and get nostalgic?
So, but 2 weeks ago, I guess, or 3 weeks ago, I was at Kansas Star Casino and commentating boxing on CBS Sports Network. Now, I've been to Kansas Star Casino a couple of times in my non-paying role as a member of the Kansas Athletic Commission, going to some local MMA shows, some house shows there. But this was the first time I commentated in Kansas Star Casino. And I hadn't even thought about it, and it occurred to me that that was where I did my last Bellator. So I didn't really feel nostalgic, but it was kind of interesting to be back there. But it was, you know, I really look back, and I think as you get distance and separation, I'm not thrilled, as I said, because I was lied to and deceived, and my agent was lied to, and there's just some very, I think, disgusting things that were done that could have been handled better. But as I get more distance, I look back on the time I had at Bellator, and by and large, I had a great time. The last 6 months weren't that much fun. After Bjorn Rebney was fired, and this is not a slight on Scott Coker because I like Scott, but it became a completely different company. And, you know, it went from Bjorn Rebney running the television production meetings to Scott Coker not even attending the television production meetings. So even though the end wasn't that much fun, overall, the run of it, it was a great time. And I'll still go back to 2010 in Bellator, far and away the most enjoyable year I've ever had in my career. So while I'm not nostalgic, and I would never go back, and I mean that sincerely, as long as Viacom owned it, I would never go back. I'd happily work for a Scott Coker promotion. But under Viacom, under Spike, zero chance. Not that they're asking me, mind you. It's not a realistic scenario on either end, and they would tell you the same thing, that they don't want me back, but I would never go back. So it's not nostalgic or wistful or I wish they would call me. But I, with distance, I can look and I can think, you know, I feel really proud of the work that I did. I still think Jimmy Smith is one of the elite combat sports, not just MMA, but combat sports color commentators in the world. Hugely talented. And I can look back and feel really good about it. And overall, it was an extremely positive experience. And I'm really happy I had those 5.5 years.
So speaking of conflicts with announcers and organizations and liars and all that stuff, what do you make of this Mauro Ranallo WWE situation? It's something that obviously Dave has written about in our newsletter and talked about and really been at the forefront in trying to, I guess, I would say push the story, but really just to make it known that something really kind of shitty happened and is happening.
Yeah.
What do you make of this whole
thing? And it's weird because I work with Justin Roberts now. I just worked on that Wichita Boxing on CBS Sports Network. And I first worked with Justin on what we were talking about when I did that your fights in Phoenix with the grappling and the Roy Jones Jr. and the Rey Mysterio and Kurt Angle. And Justin and I have gotten to be very good friends. And I was honored when he asked me to read the manuscript of his book to give him some suggestions. And that was in there, but as much as I'm a lifelong mark, I've never worked in the wrestling biz. And outside of being backstage on maybe 12 shows in my life, I really don't have the experience of the wrestling culture. But I read it, and I thought, wow, this is really interesting, the bullying and the intimidation. And then it starts to come out on Mauro Ranallo. I like Mauro. Mauro and I are very friendly. I wouldn't say that we're friends and that I think someone is a friend. That term's used very loosely, as you well know.
Yeah.
A friend is someone who I'm going to call on the phone, I'm going to talk with, and I'm going to hang out with. Mauro and I are very friendly. If I'm at a show and he's commentating, I go up and we'll talk for 15 or 20 minutes, and he's done the same thing with me, and I really like him. I think he's a massive talent. There are a lot of MMA commentators, although I wouldn't say who publicly, who I don't think are very good. I think Mauro Ranallo is great. I think he's great in MMA. I think he's great in boxing, and I think he's great in pro wrestling. And he's been extremely candid on what he goes through on a personal level. And it's unfortunate. If that was the situation with JBL that pushed him out or pushed him to a point where he couldn't continue to do his job effectively, I think that's sad. I think that's really tragic. But this is definitely hitting hard, and I think then it mixes in with what's very hot in our society right now with anti-bullying and mental illness awareness. it's weird for me to see this, first with Justin and reading about what Justin had written when I read the manuscript of his book, and now hearing with Mauro Ranallo. So as I say, Mauro Ranallo and I are friendly, but not friends. I have his cell phone number, and I've just texted him to wish him well, but we don't have the friendship where I can call him up and say, hey, happened. There are a lot of people I could do that with. I can with him.
Right.
I hope it works out well for him in some capacity or another, and I know Showtime is standing behind him because the guy is a huge talent. There's no question.
Yeah. Yeah. And obviously all of us kind of wish him well, and I wouldn't say wish well for JBL and his future endeavors, but we'll see what happens.
No, absolutely. Yeah, and absolutely. And, you know, you hear those stories and you know, I guess it's legion in the wrestling business. And I'm approaching this now as a fan. Again, someone who's never worked in pro wrestling at all, but Right. Someone who counts himself as a lifelong fan, probably from the age of 5 years old, that you hear these stories of young wrestlers really being pummeled and having their head shaved and being shot at and just all sorts of crazy stories over the years. But I guess you would think that as we're in the year 2017 and it's a publicly traded company like the WWE, that maybe that doesn't exist. Like, maybe that's the stuff of my childhood of the 1980s with Central States Wrestling and Memorial Hall. Right. That is still going on. I don't know if shocking is the right word. I guess it's surprising.
Yeah. I don't know if you heard this, but Pat Miletich wants to have a word with Mr. Layfield.
Well, it's funny because Mauro Ranallo, if you look at who are his really close friends, is I understand that his two best friends in the world are Frank Shamrock and Boss Rutten.
Oh, my God.
And he and Pat Miletich are very close as well from having done the Strike Force shows at Showtime. So those are three pretty good guys to have on either side. And, you know, all three of them, too, would, if it came to it and they felt that they needed to intervene physically, I think they would probably do so their friendship and respect and loyalty for Mauro.
I do too. And God help JBL.
Can you imagine? Wow. Can you imagine?
Yes, I can. I'd love to see it. I'd pay for that. I'd pay for that on your fight too with you calling the action. Absolutely. Chalk me up. I'm there.
It'll be Rampage Jackson, JR, and myself again. Oh, we'll call that.
Oh, my God.
Maybe we'll get Riff Raff in. Maybe it can be a battle royal.
Well, I want to talk about the podcast in a minute, but I got to get some in-cage stuff. And obviously,
absolutely.
And so I had I was telling you before, off air, as the pros say, is I reached out to you before any of the stuff with Chris Weidman and Gegard Mousasi and the New York State Athletic Commission, Dan Mirigliotta, I'm completely mispronouncing that, happened.
Sorry, Mirigliotta, you're fine.
There you go. Big Dan, we'll call him that. I had reached out to you to be my guest this week before any of that happened. As luck would have it, all that happened on Saturday night in the co-main event. It's from someone that, as you mentioned, obviously the Kansas Athletic Commission, and being well-versed, and I think one of the few announcers that really has delved into this regulatory world and understanding refereeing. You mentioned your friendship with John McCarthy. I just have this feeling that you're a relentless question asker when it comes to all these things.
I am trying
to understand. When you're seeing all that play out on Saturday night, what is going through your mind?
So I was commentating in Cancun and at the same time as UFC 210. So yes, immediately when we get off air, I go online because I commentate. I have a laptop. All my notes are in Microsoft Word on my laptop. But I'm not someone, I don't want to be on social media while I'm on the air. So I turn the internet off. So I turn the internet on. Immediately, I'm going to SureDog getting the results. And then I'm looking at MMAfighting.com and I'm looking at MMA Junkie and I'm seeing the stories and thinking, oh, what's going on? So I have a Fight Pass subscription, but I just went to MMA Core because it was faster. For those listeners who don't know this, and forgive me on the piracy, but MMA-core.com, I mention on my podcast all the time, you can find fights and you can find them quickly and you can find them for free. It's a great resource for that. So I found the fight. I thought, wow. And when I landed back in the U.S. on Sunday, I immediately called McCarthy. I said, John, they're going to be mad at us again because John and I serve on the MMA Rules and Regs Committee, and it was our committee that first put forth this new grounded fighter rule, which ultimately got adopted at the ABC convention last August. Here's the breakdown on it. So in that situation, under the old rules, Weidman or any fighter in that position, but let's use Weidman in this position, puts his fingertips down, he's a grounded fighter. The reason my committee made the recommendation to change it to both hands, and you have to be fists or palms down, not just fingers, because the system of what referees call playing the game, tapping down the finger, trying to time to take the knee and say it's a foul knee and I want a disqualification or I want a point deducted against my opponent. So the reason we changed that for fighters playing the game. So Weidman has the fingertips down. First knee lands. It's a legal knee by Mousasi because he's not grounded under the new definition. Weidman then realizes, and he talked about this in his post-media or his post-fight media, including immediately after in the post-fight presser. He then thinks, all right, I know the new rule. I've got to put both fists down. He puts both fists down, so he has now grounded himself. But Gegard Mousasi, being a very smart and very talented fighter, in that front chest hold, pulls up Weidman as he is throwing the knee. So one hand, two hands, fingertips, palms, fists, it doesn't matter. Gegard Mousasi has lifted up Chris Weidman, so his hands are off of the canvas. So the second knee is the second knee strike is legal. Now, what Weidman should have done is he should have just dropped to a knee. Rather than put himself in the very awkward position of being on 4 points, he should have dropped to a knee. And I understand there are disadvantages to dropping to a knee, yeah, but less so than going 4 points down. The intent, and I think a lot of the enemies of the new grounded fighter rule have missed, we don't want people to be in the four-point position, no more than we want them to be in the three-point position. We want them to scramble out or declare themselves grounded and take a knee, because then immediately it takes legal strikes to the head with the knee or kicks to the head off the table because you're a grounded fighter. Dan Margulies, who's a really good friend of mine, really good friend, and I think he's a great referee. He didn't have his finest moment, and I'm not embarrassed to say that. I think Dan would tell you that. What Dan was able to do, though, was to ultimately get it right. So in this situation, and also McCarthy comes up. Now, I know McCarthy has been getting a lot of heat. What are you doing, John? People don't understand, even a lot of fighters, unfortunately, don't understand. When a referee who's been assigned to the show is not actually doing that fight, they still have an actual position. It's called the outside referee. In soccer, the equivalent would be the fourth official. Mm-hmm. You're still there. You can still consult. It's not as though John had bought a ticket and came down from row JJ with a beer in his hand. John is there. He was working on that card. He had the next fight, the main event. So John immediately says to Dan, it was legal. The referee can consult with the outside referee. He can consult with the judges. He can consult with the doctor, with the commission table. Just like in the NFL, when you see, like, the head linesman maybe misses a call, and then who comes over? The line judge, and then the side judge, and then here comes the referee, and they work to get it right. New York is an athletic commission. They're still learning how to be an MMA state. And procedurally, it looked pretty clunky. And Dan Mergliotta got it wrong first, and then he got it right. But in that situation, it's a legal knee. Now, as I understand it, from people who were there and were living it, Weidman thought he was an illegal knee. He was saying that he couldn't continue, and he was making claims as such that he couldn't continue, thinking that it was probably going to be a disqualification win or at worst a no contest. When it was determined that it was, in fact, a legal knee, then he changed to, no, I can continue, I'm fine. A referee in that situation, if they know that a foul was legal, should say to the fighter, look, I know that that was legal. You know that was legal. You have one of two options. You can either restart this fight, or if you're going to tell me you can't continue, then you're going to lose. And that's fine if you're going to lose by a TKO. So Weidman, as I again understand it, from talking to people who were there and heavily involved, Weidman was first saying he could not continue, and then when he realized that it was, in fact, legal, said, I can continue. It could have been handled better by Mergliotta at first. It could have been handled better by New York. But in that situation, once Dan stopped it and realized that it was his mistake, if Weidman says, I'm fine, I can continue, I can go, you restart them in that same position. If Weidman legitimately injured, says he doesn't want to fight, whatever, you can't force someone to fight. Then he loses by TKO. So he lost by TKO. It looked bad. It played bad. It was embarrassing for New York. It was embarrassing for Mergliotta. But that's the result. There are only one of two outcomes in that situation once the knee was determined to be legal. You either restart in that position or Weidman loses by TKO, and Weidman lost by TKO.
So the one thing that really struck me is that, again, with these unified rules that are they're legal in some states, not legal in other states.
Oh, it's awful.
All this. Can you imagine, like, you know, you're a soccer guy and soccer commentator, and sure, well versed in other sports as well. Can you imagine, like, you know, where it, say in football, and if the Chiefs played in Foxborough against the Patriots, and that first downs were only 8 yards in Foxborough, but they were like, you know, 12 yards in Kansas City, and they were, you know, 6.5 or something in Oakland, but you really didn't know, and you have to remember every single time, okay, the rules are different here, we're different here.
Terrible.
It's the most bizarre thing that this sport that is, when it's great, it's really great, but when this stuff happens, it's so frustrating to watch, not only as a fan, but also as someone that is, you're just hoping, like, aren't we past this yet? You kind of wonder, like, how do we get past this as a sport in general? And how do we make it better? And how do we, you know, rules take a long time to get to get passed and all this, and to make the sport better. There's no, you know, it's not like the NFL or Major League Baseball where there's a rules committee where
right.
all of a sudden in an off season they can change stuff. How do we make this better?
Well, I'm learning this the hard way, and one of the real hard lessons is I've gotten into the regulatory side, which is my very involved, non-paying job. I was on the phone all day today as I'm trying to be a commentator and doing the weigh-ins and my fighter meetings and doing all this regulatory stuff, and I love it because I'm passionate about the sport, and I genuinely care about MMA, and that's why I'm doing all this regulatory stuff that doesn't pay me anything, and fair enough. I don't get paid to be on the Rules and Regs Committee. I don't get paid to be on the Kansas Athletic Commission. If they offered me money, truthfully, I would say take it back. I don't want anybody to perceive any conflicts of interest. And I feel like my motives are pure and my hands are clean when I'm not being paid for any of this. I genuinely, as I think all of us on the right side of these issues are, I think we genuinely want to improve the sport from a safety aspect, from a competitive aspect, from a fan-friendly aspect. We want the sport to be better. But in the UK, you have something called the BBBC, not the BBC, the BBBC, which is the British Board of Boxing Control. That is a federal body that oversees all professional boxing in the United Kingdom. There's no equivalent of that in the United States. People talk about the ABC all the time. I'm heavily involved in the ABC. Mike Mazzulli, I count him as another really dear friend, the president of the ABC, who's been great. And Mike will tell you, I'll tell you, any of us in the ABC will tell you, the ABC is a confederation. It's a confederation of all of these different athletic commissions. Some are state and some are Native American. And you're only as good as a body as you are of your individual members. So we passed the unified rules of MMA. I'll give you three states as examples. So when we voted 42-1. Tennessee said they didn't want to vote because the person told me very apologetically, he looked like I was going to tie kick him in the head. And I was like, don't worry about it. He said, man, I'm new to MMA. I don't know. I just thought I better not vote. I said, dude, whatever. That's fine. John Lewis from Mississippi wasn't in the room when we voted. I don't know why. But of the actual votes cast, there were 43. 42-1, the new rules package passed. So I'll give you an example of three states and show you how confused it is with the ABC. New Jersey voted no. They didn't adopt the unified rules. That's their right. Fair enough. Colorado and Joseph Mason said, Sean, absolutely, you have my support. Colorado voted yes. First UFC of 2017, Colorado says, nah, we changed our mind. We're not going to put in the new unified rules. Hey, that's their right. State like Missouri, they boycotted coming to the, and they'll probably take umbrage with me saying boycotted. It was my view they boycotted, but whatever. They didn't attend the last ABC convention. So, and they're part of, Missouri's part of the group that's launching a, and I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but there's a competing ABC that's being launched, and Missouri's part of that. For whatever reason, whatever verb you want to use, boycotting, what have you, they chose not to come and they didn't vote. And they didn't put in the new unified rules. Just because they're the unified rules of MMA doesn't mean anybody has to use them. If a state says, I want to do 3-on-1 MMA, if they can get it through their legislature and they can get it through their rules and regs as a state, they could do it. If they said, we want to have stomps to the head, they could do it. They can do anything they want if they can get it approved at the state level. The ABC, again, is not a federally mandated body. They're a collection of all of these different commissions, and it's a gentleman's agreement. And if someone says, no, I don't want to use these rules, or I want to use these rules, or I don't like this, or I'm boycotting, or I'm not going, then you start to see the cracks in it. There's some phenomenal members of the ABC, California, Mohegan, New York, even though they had a rough time at UFC 210, but they're going to be a really good member. Nevada, I'm really proud of what we've done in Kansas. Nebraska, where I'm talking to you from for this victory, Brian Dunn, a former pro MMA fighter, heads what I think is one of the best commissions in the country. And then there are states who are on the outside that want to do their own thing. I think ultimately it's a lot of petty politics, and you're putting fighter safety in jeopardy. Because why should a fighter have to think, wait a minute, am I grounded now? What did Colorado decide? Okay, I'm fighting in Colorado. So they voted for the new rules, but then they changed their mind. Now, what makes me a grounded fighter? That's not a safe situation. Other than literally an act of Congress, not figuratively, but literally an act of the United States Congress to create a federal, a true federal body, unfortunately, you're going to see this. There are too many different personalities and too many egos and too many bureaucrats involved, and there are too many people in these positions as head of athletic commissions who care nothing about athletes, nothing about fighters, nothing about combat sports. A lot of them don't even like MMA, and that's what really appalls me.
So as fans, is there anything that fans can do to help influence? You know, I know that, civil
action.
Yes, yeah. So civil action is obviously big these days with a certain person in the White House, and people are more in tune with learning who their Congress people are and all that. As MMA fans, so what can they do to help and influence and have their voice be heard?
If you're in a state that's not using the new unified rules of MMA, find out who that athletic commissioner is. Sometimes they're called the athletic commissioner. Sometimes they're called the boxing commissioner, which drives me crazy. Someone called the boxing commissioner is overseeing MMA. Sometimes they're called the executive director, the executive officer. But every athletic commission has a head. And it will be published because it's a public job, and you will be able to find them and email them, call them, say, I want to know why we're not in line with the unified rules, and pester those people to get on the right side of history. That's the best that you can do. Look at the states that have refused to adopt the unified rules. You know, New Jersey used to be one of the leaders. I think New Jersey has had one UFC since 2015 with no plans to go back. Bellator completely abandoned New Jersey. Yeah. They voted against. States who I think are being oppositional just to be oppositional, I think they're hurting themselves. But more importantly, I think they're hurting their fans. And I'll tell you, for instance, this UFC in Kansas City, Missouri, and I'm a Kansas Cityan, but I'm also a Kansan. Kansas City is a weird quirk of geography. We're a city of about 2.5 million people, and geographically about half of our metro area is on the Kansas side, and about half is on the Missouri side. So Sprint Center, where I'm going to see UFC on Fox on Saturday night with my 11-year-old daughter Ellie, that's about 2 miles into the state of Missouri. Now, had it been in the state of Kansas, 2 miles to the west, I would be sitting at the commission table, and it would be using the new unified rules. But because it's 2 miles east of the state line into Missouri, they're not using the new unified rules. So they're not using the new grounded fighter definition. Female fighters can be put in jeopardy, I think, in what they wear. We're seeing that in Invicta all the time because they've refused to adopt what we thought were both safety and modesty protocols for female fighters. They've not put that in. Then people have a much higher chance of being poked in the eye because they've not adopted the measures with the outstretched fingers. And that's on the Missouri Commission. So they have this UFC. Will the UFC continue to go back to those states? I'm not sure. I can tell you that John McCarthy refused to do that UFC because John has said publicly and privately he is not going to referee in states that are outright refusing to implement the new unified rules of MMA. Now you get other referees to do that. Now we're getting somewhere.
Almost like a union without being a union. Very interesting stuff. Perfect segue into the action coming up this weekend is the UFC heads to Kansas City, Missouri for a big show. A Fox show that, I think sometimes we kind of lose track of some of the depth of some of these cards because we really don't get a good chance to reset. And we just had obviously a big or a pay-per-view this past weekend and kind of coming up on another run of shows. This show from top to bottom, and I hate using the term stacked because I think it's so overused in promotion. Oh my God, every single promotion.
I know it's Ramada in Fight Night, a stacked card of stellar amateurs. Yeah,
right. All yeah, very verbose and just so. But however, if I look up and down this card, I love seeing. Like anyone, seeing names that I am familiar with and guys that if you look at the prelims, Aljamain Sterling, a guy that was almost right. signed by Bellator. They kicked the tires on him a little bit during his free agency and had a little bit of a tough run after he got re-signed. Looking at some big things, he's kind of looking to get back on track here on the prelims. You have guys that, you know, like, you know, for you know, Zach Cummings, for example, people are familiar with the tough days, and Anthony Smith is fighting on the prelims, Ashley Evans Smith, and so on. You go up a little bit further on the prelim card, Tim Elliott, who gave DJ Demetrius Johnson such a great fight his last time out, taking out Lewis Smolka. Bobby King Green, always kind of an interesting personality. Alexander Volkov, the former Bellator heavyweight champion, if I am correct, taking on Big Country.
That's absolutely right.
Yeah, taking on Big Country Roy Nelson. And then you have a really fun four-fight main card. So this, you know, this show, we always kind of look at the pay-per-views like, oh, why isn't this happening? Why isn't this happening? And some of the frustrations there. This is a pretty fun show that you're going to be seeing Saturday night. I like this card a lot.
It's a great card. I'm really excited. I get to see Jacare Souza fight, one of my favorite fighters. I've never seen him fight in person. Tim Elliott's a Kansas City guy. And I would say after James Krause, Tim Elliott's probably the most popular fighter in Kansas City. He and James Krause are at the same gym, Glory MMA, which Krause owns. And Tim Elliott's going to have a lot of fans. You mentioned Anthony Smith, who was on the Bellator prelims. Bellator unwisely never signed him. That one's on Bjorn Redney. Bjorn Redney had his chance. He didn't see the potential in Anthony Smith. Anthony Smith fought in Victory and now in the UFC, and he's in Omaha. There's buzz in Omaha about the UFC. I think you'll see quite a few people making that three-hour drive down I-29 and I-35 into Kansas City from Omaha. You mentioned the card Volkov against Nelson is a really fun fight. And I like Alexander Volkov a lot. I got to know him as a person when he was in Bellator. He's a really cool guy. He's a very underrated fighter. And it's a great main event. You get a world title fight. Poor Demetrius Johnson, though. I mean, he's arguably the best fighter pound for pound in the sport. And they never want to have him main event pay-per-views. Not that there's any dishonor in main eventing one of the Big Fox shows, but still, it seems like they just don't want to have him lead a pay-per-view that maybe at 125, they just don't feel that he has that marketability. But he's a great fighter. And his trainer, Matt Hume, is someone who I know back from my Pride days in 2006 and 2007. You're right. It is an absolutely stacked card. Stacked card is an overused word. We're talking about the word friend being overused. Everyone's everybody's friend. But, yeah, stacked card is the same way, too. But, yeah, this is a really stacked card. People in Kansas City are talking about this. I always know if it's permeated, if people who kind of are vaguely aware that I'm some sort of fight guy who like might know me from my kid's school or they see me not at my MMA gym where I go get beaten up weekly, but at my workout gym, if they're like, hey, you're that fight guy, what's this UFC thing coming? I've been hearing that a lot in Kansas City. I looked at the card and it's funny. The UFC, they were nice enough to give me a pair of free tickets. So I'm taking my 11-year-old girl, Ellie, and we go to fights together all the time. Especially with the Kansas Commission. She doesn't like it when dad's commentating, but she likes to sit and watch the fights with dad, and she does Muay Thai at American Top Team in Kansas City. So we saw ticket pickup is at 2, and the first prelims are at 3. Now, we're the type of family, we're going to be there for the first prelims. I can't imagine there'll be 500 people in Sprint Center, but I was like, yeah, 3 o'clock, that's right, because Fox wants them off the air at 9 local time, 9 central time, but it's strange that you think a 3 o'clock start and then the big fights will really start rolling and it's 7. But I haven't seen attendance figures. Sprint Center is a pretty big building. It's an NHL NBA size arena. I imagine if they sold it out, you'd be looking at about 20,000 tickets. I don't know if they'll get that. I think they'll have over 14,000. And it's a really good card. First time ever for the UFC in Kansas City, either side of the state line. First time in Missouri. I would like to say I wish they were a couple miles to the west in Kansas, but you know what? Whatever my personal feelings are for the Missouri Office of Athletics, it's great for Kansas City. It's great for the Midwest. It's great for the area. One, that the UFC is making its debut here, and two, that they're giving us a really good card. So many fighter friends of mine, like mid-tier guys, mom-and-pop show-level guys, Amy, are coming to this show, and it's going to be a cool crowd. It's going to be one of those crowds where you're going to run into a lot of friends. It's almost going to feel, I think, like a convention that the fight community is going to turn out.
Yeah. Talk to me a little bit about Demetrius Johnson. We've talked on this show about his plight before, and he's got into a run where he's, finishing guys and some exciting fights. I think I'm at the point with him now where it's not him, it's the rest of the division that needs to kind of pick things up a little bit. It's a weird conundrum that UFC is in. And I point back, and I'll always point back to the Henry Cejudo example. Henry Cejudo, by all rights, should have been fighting for at least one more year in the UFC before he got a title shot. We get, three more fights under his belt. He may lose one along the way, but if he wins them all, just guys that, he gets more seasoning, gets more experience, and kind of builds that train a little bit to, going to wrestling parlance, building that program up to finally fight the champion. And he just had this feeling that he was going to get that title shot way before he was ready. And he did. He didn't look good in that fight. And now we're kind of set back a little bit for Henry Cejudo. DJ is so good that he needs like new fresh meat all the time, because he's one of these champions that likes to stay busy. So they have to figure out, they have to do shows like Tough and have this championship thing to try to find him a new contender. And good thing, good on Tim Elliott for giving him a run for his money. But now you have Wilson Hayes going in there against him. Not a lot of buzz for this and so on. It's just, I think the rest of the division has kind of let him down a little bit in that there hasn't been a lot of guys that got to that level. But you also, he has not given anyone else a chance to kind of build up over time. And unfortunately, you have these, uber talents like Joe Benavidez, who unfortunately has just got beat by DJ twice, that there's not a lot of momentum there for a third fight, even though Benavidez, by all rights, really has earned that shot, a year ago. So it's just the flyweight division, it's unfortunate, but it's just kind of this weird position that it's in.
It really seems like it's the parallel of women's 145, both in the UFC and in sport wide.
Yeah.
And then you have a dominant number one, and then you have a few really good fighters who probably aren't going to beat that number one, and then you have absolutely no depth whatsoever. And that's unfortunately the case at 145. So earlier as we're talking, and I'm telling you about the victory card that I have, we have Rafion Stotts, who's fighting for the victory 135 title against Rob Emerson. At the weigh-ins earlier tonight, I'm speaking with my buddy Joe Wilk, who's my broadcast partner, still an active pro fighter. And Joe said, if Rafion could cut to 125, he'd probably get a title shot in the UFC in a year. But I don't think that Rafion could go to 125. He's a natural 35er. But just look at the difference. So I'm not saying Rafion's going to be Rob Emerson, but and I don't want to disrespect Rob in any way, but if Rafion beats Rob Emerson, he goes to 8-0. The UFC is probably calling. If he goes to 135, how long before he gets a title shot? If he goes to 125, I think he gets a title shot very quickly. I mean, it's conceivable that at 125, if Stotts beats Rob Emerson, he wins two fights in the UFC. Now he's 10-0, and now they're giving him to Demetrius Johnson. But at 135, is he going to get a title shot by winning two fights in a row in the UFC? There's no chance in the world. It just goes down to depth. And it's unfortunate. It's unfortunate for Chris Cyborg at 145 for women. It's unfortunate for Demetrius Johnson for men at 125. I did love the Tim Elliott fight. It was actually my favorite fight of 2016. But, Tim Elliott is a guy who, again, it almost felt like, and I like Tim, and I've known Tim forever. I've known Tim from when he was starting out in this sport. And I don't want to sound disrespectful to Tim, but I think a lot of fans saw it as a gimmick fight, that Tim Elliott had to come through tough to get this.
Yep.
And you're so right on Henry Cejudo. So much talent. And if Henry Cejudo is a 155er, he's probably 3 years away from that fight. And yet they fast-tracked him into it. It's a difficult situation at 125. Just if you look across the sport, Bellator doesn't even have a 125 division. They never have. World Series of Fighting doesn't have 125. There are a decent amount of 125ers in one championship, but most of them are lower-level Asian guys who never really fought any serious competition. there's just not that depth out there. And I hope that it, and hope is the right word, I hope that it doesn't ultimately hurt the career of Demetrius Johnson, because he just doesn't have that great rivalry. You know, you think in combat sports, especially in MMA, but all across combat sports, I guess in individual sports in general, fighters oftentimes are made by that one great rival. And who is that for Demetrius Johnson? It could have been Henry Cejudo. It didn't turn out to be. So who's really that one great rival? Wilson Hayes, he was in Bellator. And Wilson Hayes, although he's incredibly talented, here's a guy who could never win a Bellator 135 tournament and was ultimately cut from the organization. So I don't think anyone is saying, if they even remember Wilson Hayes from the Bellator days, a guy who got cut by Bellator 135, he's not really my idea of a 125-pound champion. I like Wilson Hayes. I think it'll be a fun fight. I think it'll be a better fight than anyone's imagining. But I also can't really envision Wilson Hayes beating Demetrius Johnson.
Yeah. With Johnson, I think his most interesting fights are at 135, and he may be a little he may be a little outsized there. But I think all these, you know, forever and myself included, as far as just kind of the excitement level for some of his fights hasn't really been there. I think if you move him up immediately, you have interest in DJ versus Dominic Cruz, DJ versus Tom Dillashaw, TJ Dillashaw, all those 135ers. I mean, you think of like, you go up and down that top 10. Those are interesting fights you could headline a Fox show with, you could headline an FS1 show with. It could be an interesting, you know, co-main event on a pay-per-view, things like that, where you're seeing this guy get challenged at a different weight class. And there's, you know, bantamweight took a couple of years to gel, and once it did, it has really been strong. It's one that, like, people talk about lightweight, but bantamweight is just fun. Featherweight's fun as well. Flyweight just really hasn't had that thing kind of bring it together. Boy, and I know he wants to keep defending that flyweight title, but man, you move him up one weight class. My hope is that he'll set the record and then maybe say, okay, let's do this next challenge. Because then, to me, he's must see TV in a much different sense now. I think he becomes must see TV in a different level if he moves back up to 135.
I think you're absolutely right, and I think we see him main eventing pay-per-views instead of main eventing the shows on Big Fox. And, you know, a moment ago I was comparing men's 125 to women's 145 on my podcast I do with Ben Askren and Joe Warren. 2 weeks ago on the show we were talking about if Chris Cyborg could cut to 135, and I don't think she can, and I certainly don't think that she will, but if she could go down to 135, look at all the really interesting fights for Chris Cyborg at 135. Now, at 145, who is there? The champions remain De Radami and Holly Holm. And what if Ronda Rousey comes back and decides to be a 45er, neither of which are probably likely.
Yeah.
I mean, who else is there? Marlos Kunin she fought Cyborg in Strikeforce and lost, and she was in Bellator and now she's retired. But like Julia Budd, who's in Bellator, is anyone really wanting to see that fighting if she were in the UFC? But at 135, there are all those options. And just as you're saying with Demetrius Johnson, at 125, it's almost like, well, they found Wilson Hayes. And I don't want to book Wilson Hayes, but a guy who was cut by Bellator because he couldn't win a 135 tournament, and here he is. But, yeah, you mentioned, like, Cruz and Dillashaw and the depth of talent at 135. I don't know if Demetrius Johnson wants to go to 135. Everyone wants something, as you all know, different in their career.
Right.
And maybe he's happy to rule that division and fight two or three times a year. He's happy with that slot and that money. And maybe he feels he just can't physically compete at 135. And so aware, as I know you are, and I think a lot of people listening are. So if you're a 135 fighter in the UFC, you're probably walking between 155 and 160. So there's always that gap ahead. And with rehydration, you could be fighting someone who weighs 12 to 18 pounds more than you. And that's stuff that Demetrius Johnson has to look at. So it's a difficult situation for him. It's weird when we're talking about, again, maybe the best pound-for-pound fighter in the sport and kind of being caught almost not in a dead zone, but in a career awkwardness that even though he's in a great slot and he has Wilson Hayes and it's going to be packed in Kansas City, Missouri, and he's on Fox – it's not maybe that Conor McGregor sort of A-list slot that he probably deserves.
Mm. The co-main event, and we'll just kind of go quick hit over some of these other just kind of quick hit thoughts. But, you know, Rose Namajunas taking on Michelle Waterson. The Karate Hottie, obviously the focus has been on Waterson, but I think Namajunas is obviously, I think should be favored in this fight, and I think actually might be. And someone that just people kind of just, you know, the people look at the Paige Van Zants and the Watersons and everything, and they kind of forget that Rose is pretty damn good and developing all the time, and I'm looking, you know, for big things for her in this fight and staking her claim to a hopefully a fight against Joanna Champion at some point in 2017. Jacare Souza, as you mentioned, I think that fight is that is very interesting for him. Robert Whittaker, a very live fighter, someone that you know, maybe a lot of the casual MMA fans don't really know that much about, but anytime he's been on you know, these FS1 shows, taking on Derek Brunson recently, entertaining fight, and one of these guys I think is going to be a real force at 185 for a while. And obviously mentioned the that heavyweight fight as well between Volkov and Nelson. I think that hopefully should be fun, kind of seeing what Nelson has left in the tank and Volkov getting a, you know, a bigger opportunity there. And then obviously we talked about Aljamain Sterling and everything there. I mean, any of those fights, those fighters sparking additional thoughts from you?
Well, I'm excited to see Jacare fight at any time. And you're right, it's a big fight for him. And if you look at Gegard Mousasi, okay, controversial, but nonetheless, Gegard Mousasi is in phenomenal form right now. And he's circling a title fight. And then Jacare, always in that title fight picture, it's really deep at 185. I'll say it's with the Waterston Namajunas fight, because Invicta is home-based in Kansas City, and the vast majority of the shows over their lifespan have been in Kansas City, including their most recent show in Kansas City, Missouri, at the Scottish Rite Temple. There are a lot of really knowledgeable female MMA fans in Kansas City, and both of those fighters are very well-known. And maybe it's just having been with him in Bellator, but I am so intrigued on that Roy Nelson and Alexander Volkov fight. It seems like in MMA, body types have sort of compressed into one, that you don't see a lot of discrepancy in body types.
Right.
But how about that with Roy Nelson? Who else outside of like mom and pop club shows at a bar looks like Roy Nelson fighting heavyweight? You just don't see that body. Now, forget the elite level. You don't see that body at the mid-tier level. That's like the entry-level AMI sort of body. And yet it works for Roy Nelson. And who else looks like Alexander Volkov? I remember after Volkov won the title in Bellator and we were on the same flight back, I was connecting through Dallas to Kansas City and he was connecting through Dallas going back to LA for training. And I was actually trying to get him upgraded in the first class with me because I had some certificates on American and trying to get him on. And I'm looking at him and I'm thinking, this guy looks like he has the frame of a 135-pound fighter and he's 6'9". He has almost no sickness to him. He has tiny wrists. He has almost no muscle density, but he is so tall and long. He does. He really looks like if he took a top 135 pounder with that level of body type and muscularity and stretched him out to be 6'9". But he is really good. I think people who followed Bellator realized how good he was when he dismantled Brett Rogers. He broke his arm, in fact, with kicks, and Rogers was never the same fighter after that. He was probably on a downward slant anyway, but that fully sealed it. I don't think Volkov really got the fairest deal in Bellator, and as thin as they are at heavyweight, I was shocked when they let Volkov and before that Blagojevanov go. But this is a fight Volkov needs to win. If he loses this, I don't know what future investment the UFC would have in him. I think Roy Nelson could overcome a loss. I don't like the term must win, but it's getting close to that must win for Alexander Volkov. Yep. I don't know if that'll be the best fight on the card. I think it's probably the most intriguing fight on the card.
So you mentioned Jacare, and I want to round this out with talking about the podcast too. You mentioned Jacare and never seeing him live before. I saw him live taking on Gegard Mousasi September 5th, 2014 at the Foxwoods Casino.
I was just down the road from you.
That's right. Yeah. You were calling an event at Mohegan Sun, a Bellator show, and they were going on obviously at the same time. And, you know, all of a sudden this, I think there was a lull between fights, if I remember right. And all of a sudden there was a little bit of a buzz at Press Row. It's like, what's going on here? What's everyone talking about? And it was Tito Ortiz and Stefan Bonner. in the cage. A man with a mask appeared, Justin McCulley. And we're like,
right.
What is going on down the street? Are we at the wrong show? What's happened here? That was, you talk about pro wrestling and everything. It made me think of that. And yeah, you're right down the road seeing a very weird scene break out in front of you.
So some inside story on that. So first of all, nobody told us anything about that as commentators. They didn't tell us anything. And nobody told Mike Mazzulli, who's the president of the ABC and the head of Mohegan. Mike was not happy. Mike goes into a violent rage if a winning fighter throws his mouthpiece into the crowd. So Mike about lost it. Mike was legitimately furious on that. And I know Tito a little bit. I know Bon a little bit. And I talked to Stefan. And Stefan said, I promise you, Sean, Tito wasn't in on it. He said, I didn't have an out on that. He said, after I did my pro wrestling spiel, I was hoping that Tito would shove me. He said, otherwise I just would have stood there looking like a complete idiot and I didn't know what to do. He said, so after I said that, I hoped that Tito was going to shove me and then I would shove him back and then we would go through that. So as far as I know, that wasn't worked. I know there are always conspiracies that was set up. I think it was Stefan with Justin McCulley, who had been a former friend and training partner, Tito Ortiz, just trying to play mind games. And Stefan Bonner is a pretty bright guy, and he knew the attention that would receive. But I don't believe Tito Ortiz was in on it, but I can promise you that nobody told Jimmy Smith and me, and nobody told the Mohegan Tribe Office of Athletics, because we were completely blindsided. We certainly didn't know that was Justin McCulley. I know Justin, but I had no idea. Someone comes in with a mask. I was waiting for the big reveal. I thought maybe it would be Randy Couture, but it was very, very strange.
Yeah, it was. I will never forget that, just because, Fox was obviously, they did the small venue, smaller cage, were right on top of the action there. But just seeing kind of this buzz and Jack Encarnacio and Chuck Mendenhall were there, just all these guys are kind of like, what? And Jack is a big wrestling fan too. And it's just like, what is going on down the street? And we could not wait to see what was happening. That was a moment in time. Connecticut was the MMA capital of the world that night.
Yeah, it was a really fun night, and that was when we felt like, wow, maybe we're really making a run at the UFC, and the ratings were fairly close. It was a good UFC. They DVR'd it, and I watched it when I got home, but that was still when I believed enough in Bellator to think, you know what, we're getting close. We're not there yet, but man, we're getting close. We're edging up on them ever so slightly.
Right. Well, we'll round out with some podcast talk and a good thing. And you've been doing this podcasting thing, some different partners here for a while. And you found two guys, two quiet guys. And I'm sure this non-opinionated, sitting the sidelines, just kind of, humdrum. And Ben Askren and Joe Warren. What caught my eye is you got picked up by Podcast One, and that was I had done a story on them a couple of years ago for the Observer site, because when they was really starting getting the wrestling podcasting game, and now they seem to be doing more MMA stuff, and you're one of the shows on Podcast One. And tell us about the show, how it kind of came together. I think you've been doing this for a while, at least with Ben and Joe had come in the mix, or kind of how things have come together and what the show is all about.
Well, it started 2 years ago, February of 2015. I was cold called by a company out of St. Louis, and they were called Ignotainment at the time. And they said, oh, we're Ignorant Entertainment. They didn't realize that wasn't a great name, and they changed themselves to Lineup Media. But they said, would you be interested in doing a weekly podcast? And I said, yeah, but I want to do it with John McCarthy. And you could tell that they valued John a lot more than me. They're like, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, definitely. Like, I think if they had John's number, they would have called him first. And funny enough, John and I, we'd been together a couple of weeks before having dinner. We were saying, it would be fun to do a podcast, but I didn't really know how to go about it. And I just didn't understand exactly how to get it launched, and who would produce it, and the recording technology, and all of that. I started in radio when I was 18, so I understand the fundamentals of that, but just the distribution. So it seemed a bit serendipitous. So John and I did it, and we did it for about 15 months. And it was when John was moving from Los Angeles to Las Vegas, and he was picking up more shows and being in Las Vegas. He also in Nevada judges boxing and Muay Thai and kickboxing for the Nevada Commission. And John is probably working some type of combat sport 48 or 49 weekends a year. And John said, Sean, I'm really sorry. You know, in no way is this a reflection on the show. I'm just not having time. And we were literally making no money. When I say no money, I mean we literally made $0.00 on the podcast. I'm like, John, I totally get it. You know, if you want to come on and be a guest, it's a huge time commitment. And I understand. He's like, I'm so sorry. I just don't have the time. And moving to a new house, and they had built a house in Vegas. I said, don't worry about it. So I said, John, but who do you think I want to get? Who should we get? And I'm good friends with a few other referees like Rob Hines and Kevin McDonald. I mentioned Dan Mergliotta. But I didn't want it to be another referee. Yeah. And just it was like, well, you're John, and now here's another referee. So John and I were banging names back and forth. And I said, it almost seems like I need two people because John is such a great personality and a great force of nature. I felt like I almost needed two people to replace that. And I was thinking Ben Askren and somebody. And John was thinking Joe Warren and someone. So John said, Sean, what do you think about asking Joe? And then these are guys who were two good friends of mine back from the Bellator days. We all started in season two, 2010. And I said, yeah, Joe would work great. And I was thinking Ben, and these guys know each other from USA Wrestling, and they're friends, and they fought in Bellator. So I called them both up, and they're like, oh, that'd be great, and it'll be really fun. And I feel like it works. Politically, they are total opposites. And they can bag on each other and make fun of each other, but they can do so in the way that, that people who've known each other 15 years and truly respect each other can. And they're outspoken and they're opinionated and they really don't care. So we continued to do the show for a lineup, and cold called my agent gets someone from Podcast One saying, I understand you represent Sean and he does a podcast, and with the success that they've had with Chael Sonnen's podcast, believe it or not, that was their only MMA podcast.
Yeah.
They were looking for another MMA podcast. And rather than trying to launch a new one, I think they've been fishing around and seeing what else was out there in the MMA space. And I don't know how they heard our show or heard of it, but they liked it enough to call my agent, and we put together a deal, and we were able to gracefully, thankfully, leave lineup MMA. And we were dark for about 2 months while we reset it and got all the contracts in place. And 4 weeks ago, we launched on Podcast One, and it's great. And I don't want to disparage lineup MMA, but it really felt like going from local TV to going to network TV. And lineup MMA, I say lineup MMA, that was the name they gave us, lineup media. We were their biggest show on the network. So, you know, we're in a position where we're being promoted on shows like Toast of Armenia and Youth Baseball Talk and shows that just don't have a lot of listenership. So with Podcast One, we go from being the biggest show to being a very small show. So now we're being promoted on Chael Sonnen's show and Stone Cold Steve Austin's show, Jim Ross's show. I listen to the Ross Report, and I'm listening, and it is halfway break. They're running our promo.
Yeah.
And that's invaluable. So it was incredibly flattering. So my agent says Podcast One wants to have a meeting. And so it's a conference call. We don't know who's going to be on. So my agent's on, Ben, Joe, myself, and the Podcast One people get on. And the guy says, hey, this is Norm. So I know immediately, because I'm a broadcasting nerd, that's Norm Pavitz. Norm Pavitz
Westwood
created
One.
Westwood One. I don't know if he's a billionaire, but he's 100-something millionaire. The guy's got a lot of money.
Lakers, he has Lakers courtside seats. He's got like four.
That's exactly. He sits next to Jack Nicholson. That's exactly right. Yep. So I quickly, during this conference call, I'm quickly texting Ben and Joe on a group text saying, guys, this is Norm Pattis. This is the head of the whole network telling us that he wants us to sign and he loves our show. And it was clear that he had listened to our show. And I thought, wow, if a guy like Norm Pattis, who has got to be worth, what, $500 million, who created Westwood One, sold it, then created Podcast One, and if he cares enough to get on a conference call with the three of us, that's the right place to be. So we've done three shows now. We're every Wednesday, podcastone.com. They gave us a new name because we did not like the name Lineup MMA. They gave us that name because they were Lineup Media. So Joe Warren came up with the name, Sean Funky and the Baddest Man, and we pitched it to them. They liked it, and we're off and running, and it's a blast. It's the same show as before, exactly the same show, just a different distribution network, and I couldn't be more pleased. As somebody who started in radio again at 18 years old, and I've always loved radio, I just haven't really worked much in radio since my 20s. It's great. It's, you know this, it's cathartic to do a podcast. It's just so much fun. And you're speaking to your crowd. That's what I love. About 5 years ago, I was pitching around through my agent, a different agent at the time, to do a weekly MMA show. And the agent at the time got the ESPN radio and Fox Sports radio and NBC radio. And they're like, yeah, no one's really interested in MMA. But with a podcast, there are enough people interested and they're going to listen. And that's why I love podcasting. And it's raw and it's fun. And you don't have to hit time marks and dump out for IDs and station breaks. And you know this. I'm preaching to the choir. It's a blast. So if anyone is so moved or so interested, it's Ben Askren, Joe Warren, and myself, Sean Funky, and the Baddest Man on Podcast One.
Yep, very easy to find. And, yeah, anyone that's listening to this show definitely has heard of Podcast One. And obviously you can get it in your apps and all that easy stuff. So, yeah, definitely check it out. Sean Funky and the Baddest Man. And speaking of time cues, Sean, we've gone an hour and a half. We could easily go for another, I think, probably hour and a half. But we'll
absolutely. We didn't even talk about Central States Wrestling. We didn't get to talk about Bruiser Bob Sweetan and Bulldog Bob Brown.
Exactly. Well, we got to have that hook in for you to come back later on this year.
That's right.
And we can just have you dump the memory bank out, and maybe you'll delve into some of those Inside Wrestling magazines in your crawl space there, and see my name there. I may autograph one for you at some point. We'll see if we can work that out.
I love that. I love that story. That's awesome.
Before I let you go, obviously you're on Twitter and doing all kinds of stuff. We talked obviously about Victory MMA, talking about the boxing stuff, but we'll give the throw the microphone to you and let you promote and where people can connect with you, and the floor is yours.
So I appreciate that. So I'm incredibly responsive. I try to be very easily accessible. On Twitter, it's at Sean Wheelock, SEANWHEELOCK. And our podcast is on Twitter. We're at MMA Pod 1, the number one. And finally, I'll put a plug out for my book. It's been out 3 years. It's being developed as a major motion picture. We're really excited about it. It's Is This Legal? That I co-wrote with UFC founder and creator Art Davey. You can still get it on Amazon and at Barnes & Noble, but get it on Amazon. You'll save about $5 or $6. It's called Is This Legal? The Inside Story of the First UFC from the Man Who Created It. And also, I'm going to be launching this on my podcast. We need to get Art Davey into the UFC Hall of Fame. This man founded it. He created it. He brought in the Gracies. He brought in Bob Meyerowitz. He brought in Campbell McLaren. He brought in John McCarthy. He brought in John Milius. This is the man who needs to be into the UFC Hall of Fame.
I would agree. And the book, we did not get into the book stuff. However, we will get to that next time. And for those people listening, maybe have this in the RSS feed, the post on the site where usually if you go to the site and stream it from there, I'll include a link to the interview Sean did with Dave and Brian. I believe it was last year at some point, almost 2 years ago, maybe, that talks about the book. As Dave has been obviously with the UFC since day one. So it was a really interesting discussion. I got a lot out of it, and I'll link that. So you can get some stuff about that, but obviously we'll talk more about the book next time you're on. But this has been a fun hour and a half, man. This is something I've wanted to do for a long time, and hit on a lot of topics and a lot more to discuss. And that's why we love this crazy world of MMA. So, Sean Wheelock, thanks so much for joining Josh Nixon's Punch Out this week.
Man, Josh, it's absolutely my pleasure. Keep up the great work, and I will speak to you soon. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Big thanks to Sean Wheelock and all of you for sticking around listening. Hope you guys enjoyed that. And, as promised, like I said, we jumped all over the map and we did not get a chance to get to talking about the book, but I will include that link in the show notes. It was a good interview that he had with Dave and Brian. And I think if I remember right, I think Art Davey was on with Dave and Brian around the same time. So unless I am hallucinating, which is entirely possible because I've been talking for 2 hours straight, I will include that link in the show notes as well. But that was interesting stuff. But we'll have Sean on again this year, talk about MMA news and talk a little bit about the book as well, because I had some other questions and I need to refamiliarize myself with the text, as they say. Not much more to add about UFC this weekend. Bellator has a show on Friday night. Eduardo Dantas in a non-title fight due to I believe the challenger not missing weight. And you forgive me if I don't remember the challenger's name. He was an injury replacement, someone I've never heard of before. He was replacing Darian Caldwell. And that was supposed to be kind of a fun fight. I don't really know anyone else is fighting on the card. It's kind of flown under the radar. I really wish, and some I kind of wanted to get into a little bit more, Sean, but I just think there's way too many Bellator shows. I think they need to just combine these, make some shows with a few more, you know, notable names and almost like challengers-esque, but there's just so much of these fights that don't mean anything. You know, these guys, we're never going to see them again. And I like names, and I think in this era, you know, where I know we're in the content era and more is more, but more is not necessarily better. And I just like, you know, I just like less shows, more names, more of an impact. If Bellator did 12 quote unquote stacked shows, we just talked about that stacked show, but like five great TV fights once a month, 12 times a year. Give me that any day of the week. And I think that'd be a much better role than what they're doing with these shows over and over and over again. But yeah, well, I'll get off my soapbox on that because you've heard me talk about that now. If you are new here, welcome. And if you're sticking around this point, I should send you some money. You can listen to our archives. There's all kinds of stuff in the archives. There's 62 other shows, variety of topics, variety of people, mostly MMA people, media people, broadcasters, all that stuff as well. So go nuts in the archives. If you have any questions on how to access that, certainly let me know. But it should be pretty easy to find. Anyone that understands to do a Google search or website search or anything like that. So it should be easy to find. And with that said, I'm going to let you guys go. You've been a great audience. Thank you very much. Thanks to Sean Wheelock for stopping by. And thanks to all of you. You make this possible each and every day with your smiles, your postcards, your letters, and your Western Union telegrams. So this has been Josh Nason. This has been Josh Nason's Punch Out. And until next time, insert catchphrase here.